north, and they may show up later, but they're not threatening now. So we're going to have a good fellowship, and the men really have a few things they need to talk about. Most people spend their entire lives trying to make their heart's fondest dreams and desires come true. I mean, after all, isn't that sort of what life is about? Well, in some people's eyes, the pursuit of happiness. And so we work hard, we pursue, we endlessly search for ways to acquire the things that we not necessarily have to have, but want. But we never imagine that getting our heart's deepest desires can possibly be the worst thing that would ever happen to us. In Romans chapter 1, verse 22, Paul writes, "Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves." And so Paul is saying that your worst nightmare may very well be God giving you over to your desires and the lust of your heart. But why is it punishment to allow somebody to achieve their fondest dreams? Here it is. Your heart can fashion those desires and the fulfillment of those desires into a counterfeit God. Romans 1:25, the next verse. "Who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." Every human being lives for something. Something must capture our imaginations. And I'm talking about capturing our heart's most fundamental allegiance and hope. We all experience that. But listen carefully. Without the intervention of God and Christ and the Holy Spirit into your heart and into those desires, the heart's greatest desire will be misguided, if it does not include the Almighty Jehovah God. Because it's then we will worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator. And when folks bow down to and love counterfeit gods, it always leads to disillusionment and disappointment. Now, let me illustrate this. One of the key central figures in the Bible is Abraham. He's called the father of the faithful. And like all men in ancient times, he wanted a son. He wanted an heir that would carry on his name. But in Abraham's case, of course, that desire had become the deepest desire of his heart. But finally, as God promised, a son was born to him when both he and his wife were way too old to be having babies. God had given them both, at that point, all they ever wanted. And no one saw it coming, but God then asked Abraham to give that up, to give everything up. According to the Bible, God made, his name was Abram at the time, later to be changed to Abraham. But Abram made God made him a staggering promise. If he would obey God faithfully, God would bless all the nations of the earth. That includes me and you. All the nations of the earth through him and his descendants. But there was a starting place. For that to happen, there was a starting place. Abram, who lived in the Euphrates River Valley, had to get up and go. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house, to a land I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. But for any of that to happen, he had to get up and go. Abram had to get up, pack up, and leave everything that was familiar. Most, all of his friends, most of his family, his safety, his propriety in the area, his peace, the peace he experienced. He had to give up all of that and go to some place God was going to show him, an uncertain destination. He was asked to give up, for God's sake, nearly all the security that human hearts desire. But he did. He went. Hebrews 11, 8 looks back at Abraham and says, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. But while God's call had demanded Abram to give up other hopes, it also gave him a new hope. He arrived in Canaan, Israel today. And in Genesis 12, verse 7, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants, I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. God would give Abram's descendants or offspring this land. That meant he and Sarah had to have a male child, although Sarah had been unable to conceive. Biologically, this all seemed impossible. But God had promised. He had promised a son. Now, years turned into decades. And the promise became even more difficult to believe. And finally, when Abram was 100 years old and Sarah was 90. Now, even back in that day, that was a way too old to be having babies. Well, then God's promise arrives. She gave birth to Isaac. And the word Isaac in the Hebrew language means laughter. Don't you know there was a lot of smiling and laughter due to that baby? And now the community would finally see that he had not been a fool to go out and carve out a baby bed, right? He hadn't been a fool to give up everything and go to a land that God would show him. He hadn't been a fool to trust God at his word. Because now he had an heir. The thing that all ancient Middle Eastern patriarchs wanted. But the question was, had he been waiting and sacrificing for God? Or was it for the son? Was it for Isaac? Was God just a means to an end? To whom was Abram, and now Abraham, who was he ultimately giving his heart to? Had he learned to trust God alone, to love God for himself, not just for what he could get out of God? Actually, the answer to that question at this point is no, he hadn't completely learned that. Not yet. He's going to, but not yet. As you read Genesis chapters 12 through 21, you might think that the birth and, of Isaac would have been the highlight of Abraham's life. I mean, his faith had triumphed. He could die a happy and a fulfilled man. But then Abraham got another call from God. And it could not have been more shocking. Genesis 22:2. Then he said, "Now take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." Isaac was now everything to Abraham. Everything. And God makes this call crystal clear. Notice God didn't refer to him as your little knot-headed boy, your little curtain climber. He said, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. Abraham's affection was teetering on adoration. Abraham's meaning in life was totally dependent on Isaac's life and well-being. I understand, God was not teaching Abraham that he shouldn't love his son. He's teaching him that you must not turn a loved one into a counterfeit god, an idol. If you place that child in the place of the true God, it creates idolatrous love. And normally that parent will strangle that child, or smother that child, rather, with love, strangling the relationship. John Levison, in his book, The Death and Resurrection of the Beloved One, helps us understand that ancient cultures were not as individualistic as ours. In Abraham's day, hopes and dreams were never for his own personal success, his own prosperity, his own prominence. Since everyone was a part of a family, no one lived apart from the family, these things were only sought for the entire clan, the entire family. And of course, the oldest son got the majority of the estate and wealth so that the family would not lose its place in society. In our individualistic culture, an adult's identity and sense of worth is oftentimes bound up in his or her own abilities and achievements. But in ancient times, all the hopes and dreams of a man and his family rested in that firstborn son. The call to give up the firstborn son would have been like asking a surgeon, "Hey, can I cut off your arms and put out your eyes?" It was unthinkable. But Levison also argues that we can only understand God's command to Abraham against another important factor in that cultural background. The Bible repeatedly states that because of Israel's sinfulness, the lives of the firstborn are forfeit. The firstborn son, forfeit. The firstborn son was to be given to God. We've been reading about that. But the family could redeem or buy that child back. Exodus 22:29. "You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and juices," and your juices, "the firstborn of your son you shall give to me." Exodus 34:20. "But the firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. But if you will not redeem him, then you shall break his back." "All the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed." And so that was a timeless principle. When God punished Pharaoh in Egypt, he took the lives of guess who? Firstborn. Their lives were forfeit because of the sins of the families and the nation. Why? Because the firstborn was the family. That firstborn son was the family for the future. When God told the Israelites that the firstborn's life belonged to him unless ransomed, he was saying in the most vivid way possible in those cultures that every family owed a debt to eternal justice, to the debt of sin. This is crucial in understanding this command to Abraham and his obedience. I mean, if God had told him, "I want you to take Sarah up on a mountain and kill her," he would have thought that he was hallucinating, because it would contradict everything God had ever said about justice and righteousness and love. It would have made no sense. But when God stated that Abraham's only son's life was forfeit, it actually was not an irrational, contradictory statement to him. Because he wasn't telling Abraham to murder Isaac. He was saying, "I want you to offer him to me. Give him to me." God was calling in Abraham's debt. Isaac would die for the sins of the family. That was the principle understood. If that command was understood as Levinson described, that did not make it any less terrible for Abraham. Abraham was faced with the ultimate question. God is holy. Our sin means that Isaac's life is forfeit. Yet God is also a God of mercy and grace. And so he said that he wants to bless the world through Isaac. How can God both be holy and just and still graciously fulfill that promise of salvation? Listen to me. Abraham didn't know the answer to that question, but he knew that God knew the answer. It's interesting. Abraham didn't sleep in till noon. He got up early. How did Abraham get up early, gather up firewood, some coals, some hot coals, and head to the mountains? Well, we get a hint in Exodus 22:5 when Abraham told his servants, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship. And we will come back to you." Isn't that interesting? Abraham didn't know what God would do, but he didn't go up that mountain saying, "I can do this," filled with willpower and self-talk. He went up the mountain saying, "God can do this. But I don't know how." Do what? God would somehow remove the debt of the firstborn and still keep the promise of grace. And so they've reached the place to where the altar would be built. The altar was built. He arranged the wood on it. He bound up his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then he reached out his hand, took the knife, and as he was ready to take his life, an angel from heaven said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." Genesis 22:12. And he said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me." That is so important. You didn't withhold him. You stayed true to me. Abraham immediately, of course, saw a ram tangled in a thicket. He untied Isaac. They sacrificed the ram in place of Isaac. What's this incident all about? Actually, it's about two things. One of the things Abraham probably saw pretty well, and the other one he couldn't have understood clearly, because It's directly tied to Jesus Christ. Now, Abraham could surely see that this was a test about who he loved most. The angel said, "For now I know that you fear God." But this was about much more than the kind of fear we might think. It's about being wholeheartedly committed to God, unwilling to be disobedient. Abraham was on a path leading him to loving Isaac more than anything in the world. And that would have been idolatry. And on that mountain, God forced Abraham to choose. Let his son live or obey God. He had to choose. God knew that Isaac was not safe for Abraham to have and hold until Abram learned this lesson, until he was willing to put God first. And as long as he never had to choose, he wouldn't be able to see that his love for Isaac could easily become idolatry. Listen, until we're clearly faced with that same choice, we won't know. Who do you love most? Is it really God? That's what this account really hits us in the face with. Is it really God? It's when you either tell the truth and remain a person of integrity or you lie and, you know, try to get ahead in your job or whatever. Who do you love most? That choice was there. If you're not willing to hurt your career or whatever endeavor you're in order to do God's will, Well, that has become your counterfeit job. You put it before God. It's when you put everything in your life on the back shelf, in its proper place, no longer taking full advantage of your favorite hobby and putting it on the front shelf, that you answer the question, who do you love the most? Deer hunting. Deer hunting is a good thing. If you never deer hunted, it's fun. Not so much having to dress the deer, but everything else is fun. Fishing. Fun. Kids' baseball and soccer games. Oh my. And then you have college and pro football and high school football and basketball and on, you name it. All of those things can become a counterfeit God. Think of your many disappointments and troubles you've dealt with in your life. If you study them very carefully and think about them deeply, likely you'll see that you've had to deal with many Isaacs on Mount Moriah. By the way, Mount Moriah is now called Jerusalem. In our lives, there are always some things that we're investing in to get a level of joy and fulfillment. But are we wanting a level of joy and fulfillment that only God can give? We've made it a counterfeit idol. The most painful times in life are when our Isaacs or our idols are threatened or are even removed. Those are our darkest days. And we respond in one or two ways. We either opt out for bitterness and despair. You know, you've heard words of bitterness and despair, right? I've worked all my life to get this place in my career. Now it's just all gone because of that person or that circumstance. I've slaved my whole life to give my child a good life, and this is how I'm repaid. It's then we may feel at liberty to lie or cheat or take revenge or throw away all of our principles to get some relief, because likely we're really grieving the loss of our counterfeit God. That's the road traveled. Disillusionment, despair. Or we can choose like Abraham and just take a walk up into the mountains and say, I can see that you may be calling me to live my life without something I never thought I could live without. But God, if I have you, if I have the love and honor and security you provide, the things that you give, then I have what I really need. I can't lose. I can face today and tomorrow and on. As many have learned and later taught, you don't realize Jesus is all you need until Jesus is all you have. And that's what Abraham realized on the mountain. We all have to demote our idols far below God, which means those good things, they can remain in our life. You can keep deer hunting and fishing and golfing or going to games or doing the things that you enjoy doing, but you have to cautiously be willing to part with them if they threaten to be your counterfeit God. You have to be willing to leave them. In other words, you have to be willing to say, because I have God, I can live without those things that threaten to become my greatest reason for living. God, you have that place alone. That's our challenge with idolatry, or at least part of it. And the lesson we learn from Abraham is invaluable. Tonight, if you need to come, if you need our prayers or whatever you need, please come now while we stand and sing.